Well, hello, witches. Here we are again. My name is Blackbird, and I, along with my good friend Scarlet, are hex-rated, and tonight, or today, or this afternoon, this is very exciting, we will be discussing the classic 1977 film Suspiria, and we will also be discussing the remake of such film that happened in 2018, I think I'm right. Anyway, I hope you really enjoy this. This is one of our favorite movies, so it was very exciting to finally talk about this one, and especially in time for spooky season, or as other people call it, Halloween. Anyway, enjoy, and thank you for listening.
I put a spell on you, and now you're mine. You can't stop the things I do. I'm love. It's been 300 years, right down to the day. Now the witch is back, and there's hell to pay. I put a spell on you. And now.
Pressing the button. Hello.
Hello.
And good day.
Greetings. Good evening.
Greetings and salutations. Before we launch into what is sure to be a wild linguistic ride for everyone, my name is Blackbird.
I'm Scarlet.
And we are Hex Rated, the podcast. Dun, dun, dun. I don't know. That just sounded fun. Wow, what have you been up to? Holy shit, it's been a minute.
Well, I've been doing I'm slightly behind on 31 Days of Witches.
Yes. Oh, but it is so good. Please let me promote your Insta page at A Witch in Red, all run together like that. Go to it. 31 Days of Witches. It is hot stuff. Hot stuff.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes.
It's been going well. Doing a lot of new characters.
Yes.
A lot of surprises, like things that I didn't know would turn out awesome that did, and a lot of more experimental photography happening.
Oh,
so I'm trying to
awesome
get in the mix with that, step up my game on that a little bit.
I love it.
So, but yeah, that's like a whole other conversation.
We did it once, but we'll conversate about that again. Conversate? I don't know.
Sure.
Look at that. Converse, maybe. You don't have to turn everything into whatever I'm trying to do. You've also been XX, you were saying.
Oh, I have gotten caught up on the Lisk podcast, Long Island Serial Killer.
Yes. Because
as we all know, they have indicted, or I guess they've arrested a suspect.
Yes.
Several months ago, after they created a new task force in 2022.
That's right.
So I was listening to the old seasons. It's kind of fascinating to see what leads ended up panning out.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of conspiracy theories
right.
going on. So it's interesting to revisit and see which wild ones were really off the mark.
Well,
but and also just like the podcast is delivering a lot more insight into what has been released, because typically when someone gets arrested for a serious crime like this, the prosecutor's office, the DA, is usually pretty tight-lipped about it.
Right.
So the only things that are available would be off the record or leaked stuff from the PD or the legal team, or things that are public record. For example, in New York City, you have to file a bail application, which is basically like, we don't think this guy should get to have bail. We think he should be in jail until the trial. And they made a really good case of that. It's a 22-page document, which is, what from what I understand, to be longer than it normally would be. But So they've got some experts coming on, sort of picking apart that document and explaining exactly what it is and what it means, and what you can read between the lines. Stuff that, even though I would consider myself pretty literate, I don't really know how to peruse these sort of technical legal documents that are otherwise pretty dry. So highly recommend, if you're into true crime, totally worth re-listening to the old ones or going back and starting over if you haven't listened to the podcast. And then all the new catch-up stuff is really, really helpful. So
yes, it is a fantastic podcast. And as somebody, like, my sister just lives like a hop, skip, and a jump from that area. And last time I went to see her, I kind of drove around and was like, man, this is desolate as fuck. I mean,
I know.
Easy place to get fucking murdered. So I don't know, stay out of the woods, but also fuck you, murderers. It was, I mean, also, but yeah, I really like that podcast. I think they go really deep with the people involved, really very respectful of the victims' families. Lots of great interview, like old interviews of the victims' families. Yeah, it's a good one. So it's LISK, right?
Yeah, Long Island Serial Killer. They also do a really good job. They get some pretty interesting players in the drama, like the former chief of police, Verone, who seems like a pretty reliable, experienced and knowledgeable guy that was kind of forced out in the early days of the case. He provides a lot of insight. And so they interview multiple times some people that actually are pretty in the mix or were at the beginning. And like you said, the main goal of the podcast is to kind of humanize these victims and bring awareness to the case and put pressure on law enforcement, and not to kind of just make wild accusations or anything. Right. So it's very responsibly done.
Yes.
It's definitely done with not a morbid sort of ambulance chaser mentality. It's very much about the victims and their families and why, these women were victimized and how the response of local media and police contributed to this going undetected for a really long time. So
yes,
highly recommend.
Yes, very good. Yes. What have I been doing listening? Oh, I know. And since I'm like, what, a year or two late reading this book, but I just finished Circe, or Kirke,
by
Madeline Miller.
Tell me your reaction.
Holy it was so good. I mean, I got toward like the last like couple of chapters and I was like, did not want it to end, even though we all know how it ends. But it's like, you know, it was so refreshing to read this story or these stories that you've known in first person. Like, it's like you're in it, like it's happening to you. You are sitting by the fire talking to Odysseus. It was just so, oh God, it was engaging. I really, really loved it. I can't talk about it enough. I don't know. I loved it. I want eight of them. I want more.
I gotta say, one of the things that I really enjoyed is obviously it's sort of like a feminist retelling of a classic story, but I feel like it's not super heavy-handed or one note.
No.
You know, Circe is super complex. Like, she's not always right. Like, she's not this Mary Sue.
Right.
So I enjoyed that very much. And I also enjoyed her giving kind of equal time to the phases of her myth. So a lot of preamble about her life before she comes to the island of Aea and gets involved with Odysseus, of course.
Right.
But I thought that was very interesting. The sort of epilogues, post Odyssey stuff was very interesting.
I really
also recommend that. We could probably spend an episode talking about that.
Oh, we sure could. But it was really enjoyable. I highly recommend. Madeline Miller is the author of that, and it was a bestseller, which also blows my mind because I'm like,
yeah, excellent.
Everybody's into Greek mythology. That's right, motherfuckers. Let's see. What else have I been doing? Well, this is on a personal note. Try as I might to not get promoted again, I'm fucking getting promoted again. Can I never get out of corporate hellscape? Guess not. Yeah, so in January I will have something new happening and I just can't fucking wait. I don't know. Yeah, that's, you know.
Well, congratulations.
I mean, also.
Sorry, that was a kind of a delayed response because the announcement was quite tepid.
It's but... not. I don't feel congratulatory yet. Although the good part is I might get to use some of my degree, which is nice because I'll be like
excellent
writing procedure and shit. So that'll be a little more up my alley, I suppose, as I can get. But anyway, enough of that. We are here to talk about a movie the remake is the thing that is near and dear to my heart. But we're here to talk about a movie of the season,
Suspiria.
And we have promised this talk for a long time and now we're gonna do it. So okay, so where do you want to start? I'm sure you might be able to tell us a little bit about the history of this film.
I really cannot, but I will try anyway. I think one of the interesting things talking about the film is, for me, obviously the original came out before I was even born. It was in 77, is that correct?
That's correct.
By the famed auteur Dario Argento. It's actually part of a trilogy. And I had seen parts of it. I didn't remember it very well at all, so I recently just rewatched it. So I came to the remake kind of more, I knew the plot of the original and the basic gist of it, even though I didn't really remember it. But, you know, like I did a quick Wikipedia Google. And so, but for me, the newer one is sort of what I'm comparing the old one to instead of vice versa, which admittedly is kind of backward. However, I think that you can definitely watch the new movie as a standalone film.
Yes.
I think that it works really well as a companion piece to compare and contrast. And I don't think that my love for the new one diminishes the appreciation or value that the original has. It's certainly not like, well, this one does it better, so we can just throw the old one away.
No. You need the original to even have any basis. But I think the thing that I had to look up and read about is how important this movie was in 1977. Now, it wasn't right out the gate like a critical acclamation, but this is now like, the original is like cult film status. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And when you watch it, you will see references to it in so many other horror movies.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. So I guess let's dive in because I have some notes. My notes are a little crazy. Now, I do want to note that the music in the original film, get ready, because it is bananas. Like,
I love it.
Well,
I love it.
I love it in the context of what it is trying to achieve. I do not love it as music. So, like,
hard disagree.
That's fine. Within the first like 10 minutes of the movie, I was highly distracted by this very piercing. Like, but it totally serves the purpose of, you are frantic. This chick is frantic. It's raining cats and dogs. She just got off a plane. She's all fucked up. Like, it's clearly evoking what the movie intends for you to feel.
I had some notes right out the gate of the music. Well, here, let's just give a quick summary of both movies.
Oh, okay.
A young girl.
Yes.
Named Susie.
Yes.
Two different spellings, one with a Z, one with an S. Ooh. However, an American girl travels to Europe to study at a prestigious but sort of kooky and eccentric and insulated dance school.
Correct.
And the moment that she arrives, there has already been some drama afoot. A a classmate has been killed or committed suicide. And she's kind of thrust into this new world, new career, everything, new country. And there's already
drama,
spookiness, yes, and crime afoot. And then as it turns out, the reason why things are so cray is that the school is in fact run by a coven witches. Of witches.
The school is witches. Right. Right. And that this holds true in both iterations of the movie. Like that is,
yes, this is both.
That is the summation of the movie. Now how that is portrayed and resolved, two different ways, but, okay. So frantic, she's coming into this country. She's very freaked out. There's a lot of rain. No, the cabbie won't really talk to her. Yeah. She's freaked out. The music is going nuts. And then she gets to the dance academy in what is apparently late night. And right away I was struck by the facade. So are we comparing and contrasting right now? Because
yeah,
I kind of want
to. I was going to say something about the music in the Argento, is the original, that I enjoyed that you did not. But it's super, it's very unhinged, and
yes,
you kind of see where that led into the 80s of like sort of what we think of as sort of classic slasher musical cues. But this is before that, so it's kind of almost got this like kooky psychedelic like jazz feel,
yes,
of like just people making weird sounds with their instruments, you know, weird time changes, like not exactly like a musical formula. But one of the things I love is I need to look this up, but it sounds like there's a celesta.
Oh,
which is my favorite. I would say it's my favorite instrument, but it is most famously used in Tchaikovsky's Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy. So da 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 da. You know that thing that sounds like little bells.
Yes, yeah.
And actually, a celesta, I believe, is you play it on a keyboard, but then instead of the keys striking a string the way they do in a piano, it's striking these little bells. And so it's a very lovely, fairy-like, magical, and I mean, I think my association of it with the Sugar Plum Fairy is apt, because it does sound very like delicate and elven or something. And of course, it's like deeply associated with ballet, you know.
Right. Yes.
Besides Swan Lake, I mean, I would say the Nutcracker Suite is the other most famous ballet. So using a very famous instrument that is most notably only used in this one ballet was interesting. Like, I picked up on that immediately as sort of like a ballet inside joke.
Right.
And then there was also these other weird noises, like almost like a didgeridoo, where there's like this whoa,
right,
whoa, like,
yes,
things that are off-putting,
very,
like, and which is why I get that you didn't enjoy
well,
it.
It's like a whole genre,
but it's meant
like difficult yeah, listening, legendary pink dots type stuff. Yeah, it's like not for me, but that doesn't mean I couldn't appreciate it in the setting that it was giving. I was just like, but I was like, whoa, are they gonna like chill on this music? Because it's freaking me out.
In contrast, the new one,
yes,
is scored by Tom York of Radiohead.
Yes.
So,
which
that is,
I'm sure that
also very bonkers and strange,
yes,
and otherworldly, but in a slightly different kind of way.
Right.
The other thing I will say in terms of sound is, if you are not used to watching older films or like Italian films in particular, it is overdubbed, the
yeah,
original,
right,
Argento,
right,
which will be cheesy and weird and perhaps off-putting to you. Obviously, the newer one does not have that problem. Everyone's audio is completely synced with what their mouths are doing. So that, unfortunately, the acting's good, and you know the dub is good, but obviously you know when someone is not speaking the lines live,
right?
You know,
yeah,
like someone went back and re-recorded it, so there is this weird stiltedness or kind of lack of affect or something,
right,
that is going to be a disadvantage.
Sure.
and is especially going to be weird if you're not used to seeing dubbed movies.
Right, right. Well, okay, so I want to talk
about... But yes, the visuals, particularly the architecture. Well, architecture is right. A big character in both films.
In both films. But I did want to say, like, to me, it was interesting. So I watched the remake first. I had not seen the original, or if I had, I had completely forgotten that I had seen the original because I did not remember really any of it. So what was striking to me is in the original, when she first rolls up to the dance academy in the cab, like, it is like bright red. Like, the facade, yes, of the building is bright red. And then in the remake, it is a very dull building. Very dull, like, on the outside. Very gray, very, you know, pre-Berlin Wall coming down. Like, very dull. So, like, what do you think of that? And do you think that was a stylistic choice to make that building less dramatic?
Well, it's a different kind of dramatic. The color palettes, yeah, are very different.
Yes.
Argento, of course, is famous for his lush visuals,
yes,
brightly saturated colors, really great abstract patterns.
Yeah.
It
was almost like it felt like an introduction into New Wave to me. Like, it looked like everything could have been almost a Nagel print, you know? Like, everything was just like almost right there into like 1980.
Right. So, it would have seemed very futuristic at the time that it came out.
Yes.
So in the very first, there's a few colors that keep coming up, and one is sort of this palette of really luminous reds. So there's a lot of lighting that is this like electric salmon.
Yes.
So like a very, very warm pink.
Right.
That's like almost an orangey pink as opposed to like a bluey purple pink.
Right.
And red, the facade of the building is red. Some of the wall, also texture is a big part,
yes,
of this, which is a weird thing to say about a film, but a lot of the rooms are upholstered in velvet.
Right.
And the female dormitory is upholstered in a dark red, like cranberry velvet brocade.
Right.
So to me, like, and then the other accent color is this like kind of almost acidic, noxious apple green,
mm-hmm,
like a Midori, like a fake, yeah, green.
Yes.
Not like a lush nature green.
No, no.
But like
bright,
kind of like a gross, like, yeah, bright green.
Yeah.
And you nailed it perfectly. In the new version, it's a lot of beige, buff, nude, gray. A lot of the atmosphere is drawing very heavily because it's a period piece,
right,
that's taking place in pre-Berlin Wall Germany. So there is that very kind of dreary, drab sort of Soviet,
yes,
style architecture, very constructivist, very boxy, very nondescript, very,
yeah,
industrial,
yeah,
looking. But then there are these pops of this like really bright crimson,
yes,
like really intense reds that are almost orange,
right,
like just like bright stoplight reds.
Yeah.
And I think that, I mean, all the interiors in Argento's film are just exquisite and bonkers.
They are
like,
bonkers.
And I would love to live in all of them.
Yes.
I feel like in the new one, the kind of luring you in with these sort of like drab grays and like, and then having these unexpected pops of color maybe is more effective, but as being kind of more of like a slap. And I think the reason for that is like this idea of sort of what is on the outside and what is in the inside, or which thing is a facade and which thing is real.
Right.
And what is a performance and what is, you know, just candid.
Mm.
But I mean, I gotta say, in terms of just visuals, gotta go with Argento. Like, the school, it, like you said, it's red. It's got these crazy, like, gothic shaped windows.
Yes, I was going to say. But
then it has these weird, like, Art Nouveau, swirly, like, lush, like ooey gooey, sinuous, like, other details, which is a really weird juxtaposition. Olga, one of the students that lives off campus, her apartment is this bonkers, so like, it's very 80s, which, again, very prescient, would have looked kind of futuristic, but like a lot of pinks, a lot of like this art deco, very bold architectural elements, very bold framing and everything.
I wrote, oh damn, the roomy friend's wallpaper is black and white and trippy as fuck.
Yes.
It's very trippy. It's great. The thing that I was drawn to almost immediately, not really, not knowing how they were going to use it, but knowing that it was clearly, hey, put your eyes on this piece of situation, was there is a door they keep showing, and it has this amazing, like, it's not really a transom, but it's like windows over the door that you see these different colored lights coming through. And it is a very big focal point. Like, mm-hmm. they keep showing that door a lot. So I was very drawn to that. I was like, ooh, that's important. Yeah. So of course, the first minute you see Madame Blanc in the original, she is a stone cold fox. I mean, can you just say eyebrows on point, mole,
oh my God,
perfection. She is amazing looking. And very disdainful. So the best. And you get the same kind of affectation from Tilda Swinton's Madame Blanc too. Like very like, this woman is not to be approached. Right?
Well, what's interesting is the Argento Madame Blanc, she's wearing like a gray tailored suit. Everything about this is super Italian, even though that is not the setting.
Yes.
So she's wearing this amazing like kind of 1940s style suit. With like a pencil skirt and like a tailored jacket, and she has her hair very done. She's wearing red lipstick, like, you know, eyebrows that could murder you, black beauty mark on her cheek, pump heels. So her severity is very much about the tailoring,
right,
and the materials and the shapes that she's wearing. Whereas Tilda is actually wearing sort of these hippy dippy artsy lady
flowy
kind of caftans
kinda, right,
and things, flowy. But of course, Tilda herself is very sculptural looking.
Yes.
Like, she's very severe with the angles of her cheekbones that could murder you.
Yes.
And like her pointy little elfin chin.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting that I think they kind of leaned into her look.
Mm.
Whereas in the Argento, they went with like a really solid actress.
Right.
And kind of used more of like her demeanor and then her
wardrobe,
her costume, and, to sort of communicate the same vibe. In either case, it's a woman who is very
clearly powerful,
stern,
yes,
very powerful, very in charge, very exacting, does not suffer fools,
right,
is very organized, very busy.
Yeah.
And
you better listen.
Yeah. And is intense.
Commanding.
Like, commanding.
Yeah.
And it sets up the dynamic that, you know, she's this figure that's maternal in the sense that she is kind of the teacher and she's the one that's in charge.
Right.
But she's not like affectionate or warm. The sort of gratification you would get from her as a mother figure is more of like her intensity.
Right.
So trying to win her approval.
Yes.
And then when you get it, that's the rush,
right,
of, you know,
winning,
feeling like you are being taken under her wing. So anyway,
right. Right. I also wrote that $50 a week in 1977 Germany for rent seems kind of high.
Yeah. Okay, wait, hold on. I'm gonna Google that real quick.
So. Okay, sure.
So, okay, $50 in 1977 is $253.95 so that's a week that she's paying.
Yeah, that's a week. So that seems real high for like
a
room in some chick's apartment.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a lot of money.
So it's like $1,000 a month.
Yeah, that's a lot in 1977. Did any rent cost that in 1977?
I mean, that's rent's really high here.
Yeah, for sure. But like,
$1,000 for just someone's room? Other room.
Well, I mean, yes, in San Diego for sure, but still, like, this is 77 Germany. That just seemed striking to me. It's like somebody just fished a number out of a hat and was like, "Here, say this."
Yeah, I don't know if you were supposed to think that sounded like a lot or not when this came out, but I also thought that was a weird detail.
Well, it was not. She didn't stay at the roomies for long. They finally find Susie a room at the academy where she can stay, and she has a friend that is her roommate. And I thought the actresses that play the roommate. Sorry, what is her name? Sarah? Yes. Sarah. In both of the films, I thought it was a really, I felt like the first film's casting, influenced the second one, because I felt they were very similar, the Sarahs. Like, kind of, like, slightly aloof, slightly, I don't want to say bitchy, but like just kind of like taking Susie under your wing a little, but also like, hey, you know, I'm here for me. I don't know. I got this vibe off of both actresses that was very similar.
I would totally agree with that. And this is where I would say both Sarahs are very similar. And the thing that struck me about my reaction to both of them is sort of where the new version takes that thread and kind of runs with it, which I like.
Yes.
And that is sort of this female cattiness, sort of social hierarchy of like women among women. And my experience when I switched schools in seventh grade from a pretty small co-ed school to a still small but slightly bigger all-girls school was there was this weird few weeks when I started. So some of these girls have been going to school together since preschool, but in seventh grade they add like kind of a new batch of girls, like 10 girls.
You were in the batch.
So everyone's kind of eyeing the new girls,
sure,
trying to figure out where they shake out into the social strata.
Right.
And so you as a new person are kind of trying to make friends because you need an anchor and you need like someone who knows what's up.
Right.
And you want to form those relationships. And you want to, it's stressful because you're like trying to put your best face forward the whole time. You feel very on guard and you feel like everyone's looking at you and judging you.
Sure.
And then of course the students that have already been there are sort of eyeing everybody and trying to see like, is this person going to be, you know, a popular girl? Is this person going to be kind of the weirdo loner girl? Like, so it's sort of like, do I want to like get attached to her too early,
right,
and be like, oh, you hang out with the weirdo girl? Or do I want to like hitch my star to her early on because I think that she's going to be like the cool, interesting new girl and I want to get in on that early? So that dynamic, I think felt really real.
Right.
And all of this is very unspoken. It's just in little moments of sort of how people deliver their lines.
How they act together. Yeah. How they
make eye contact or don't or whatever.
Right.
And that's a point at which the movies kind of diverge, because in the new movie, as far as I can tell, all the students are female.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
And there isn't really any male staff at all.
No.
Whereas in the Argento, there are male students that are dancers, and there's male staff.
And there is one creepy male nephew.
Yeah, there's a creepy little boy, and then there's also like a creepy kind of lurch,
yes,
like style butler guy.
Yeah. Right.
And I think making the space exclusively feminine is a strength of the new movie, yeah. which I'm going to probably keep touching on as we get into other stuff about it. But I think that change, I was actually a little bit surprised on rewatching the Argento to realize like how heavily populated it is with men.
Yeah. Yeah. I get it, but right. Like I feel like you said, it's a strength of the remake to reserve that space for women only, I think. A lot of stuff. So like you said, this is kind of where the movies diverge. They kind of like both take a similar but different tack. I mean, basically now it is just figuring out if you're in a witchcraft coven or a dance company, or both. Personally, I think the newer film does a way better job of making you like, I was surprised. I really expected dancing in the Argento film, and there's very little.
Yeah.
If any, there might be like a couple of warm up scenes where they're in a warm up room and doing a little. Oh yeah.
They're really just noodling around.
Yeah. I mean, they're just stuff noodling around. Like, Susie's feeling faint and stuff. It's very like, it's very, just barely touched on. Whereas I'm just going to jump to it because to me, it's the most impressive part of the movie. The choreography in the new Suspiria is fucking amazing. Like, what I would not give to be doing those
if you're
dances.
Gonna be like, oh, here's God. A witchcraft ballet school. I mean, you would think that their dancing would be fucking mind-boggling.
and it is. It's so great.
And it serves a narrative purpose.
Yes.
That's another thing. I think that the new one is very ballet focused. I think that is sort of where the color palettes brought in.
Right.
You know, we were talking, it's like a lot of black and gray and nude and buff and like,
yes,
you know, pale pink and things, which are of course standard ballet warm-up colors.
Yes.
You know, like nude or pale pink, black and gray,
buff,
and
right.
Then of course the stage costumes in a ballet are quite opulent,
right?
So that's sort of right out of the gate, just in ballet in a non-supernatural setting,
right,
has this built in of this huge divide between behind the scenes and on stage.
Yes.
You know, behind the scenes things are very muted,
right.
Colors, very clean, like unadorned,
right.
And then on stage it's completely different. It's super magical and fanciful and feminine and over the top and whimsical and stuff. And so I think that becomes a theme. Same thing with like the architecture being very bland on the inside and then having some of these interiors be more elaborate or more mysterious or just more provocative in some way. And I think also with ballet, there's anyone that's ever had to do ballet or voluntarily did it. I feel like a lot of young girls are involuntary, like
forced
ballerinas.
Into ballet. Yeah.
But that's also a part of it. I mean, you see these like horrible photos of ballerinas' feet when they're not in the point shoes, how they're like all like bandaged up and bleeding.
Yes.
The very unglamorous side of something that seems so supremely feminine and graceful and effortless, right. And the fact that it is absolutely not. And also that it's one of these art forms that, I mean, it's like being an Olympic athlete.
Yeah.
Like
it's
not just you are hoofing it to like a snappy tune,
no,
and
no.
Like your enjoyment is infectious to the audience. It's like you've been getting up at like 4 a.m. since you were like four
Six.
Years old.
Yes.
Doing these grueling practices, you know, having your entire physique critiqued on the daily.
Yep. Having
being
a body that is probably racked with pain most of the time from any autobiography that I've ever read of ballerinas. It's just like, it's torturous.
Yeah, well, and it like reshapes parts of your body. Oh, yeah, sure. And just like being an Olympic gymnast, there's a little bit of nature and a little bit of nurture. Like certain body types exclude you from it, regardless of your natural aptitude or the intensity of your effort.
Right.
And then on the flip side, it very intense training also tends to mold you into a certain shape. So obviously somebody who is like just born super tall or super short is going to be excluded from this sport. But also like, and obviously you want to be as svelte as possible,
right?
Because you're trying to look, you know, sinuous and weightless, but then also like these exercises
you have to be weightless
and the type of training
them.
They
right.
do.
Right.
Like layers your muscles in a way that they are long.
Right.
You're not like putting on mass. So the fact that it's this very grueling process, that's very unglamorous behind the scenes, that is not usually the kind of joyful artistic expression that you might get with other, I mean, art school's the same way. Like the sad truth is that like music school, art school, dance school, like a lot of these professions are kind of a beat down emotionally.
Well, right. Like it's all about what it's all about the product. Like it's,
yes.
What do I want to say? What you show to the world, it's not what you're going through. Like the world only wants to see your process sometimes.
Right.
And they really don't want to see your whole process.
No, they don't.
They do not.
And you as an ingredient to that final product, part of you being good at your job is to be anonymous.
Right. Yeah.
You know, like you're not bringing your own interpretation or your own quirky look or your own choreography, you know, like.
Right.
But I think that the Argento is definitely playing with facade versus reality, or expected versus unexpected, or, you know, things that seem wholesome or benign that are really sinister. That's obviously a big theme. But I feel like the strength of the new movie is that by leaning into the ballet setting, I think they set up a lot of that in a very completely non-supernatural way. And even if you haven't done ballet, I feel like a lot of these themes like speak to being a young woman, either as a teenager or like in your early 20s as a young professional, that, you know, this idea of sort of beauty is pain.
Yep.
And
yeah.
Feeling constantly being appraised critiqued, based on your appearance.
Yep.
And sort of performing this weird, very sterilized, stylized femininity, and this being a very woman-centric sphere. I just think that really spoke to me, and maybe that's just me personally because I went to a girls' school and I did go to art school, so I was just like, it was giving me a lot of feels right out the gate.
Right. No,
but did you, I mean, you didn't have that experience. Did you also feel like it felt really authentic in presenting?
I mean,
you know,
I was a dance minor for a little while in college. So, yeah, I mean, to be critiqued with, it's very hard to feel like you're good at anything when someone is constantly telling you what's wrong with the thing you just did or how you can do it better. You know, like it. While you want to take that criticism in and fine tune your performance, it's still damaging to your psyche in one way or another to me. Like it's not, I was never able to look at it. And I mean, hence why I'm not a professional dancer, but like I was never able to just take it in, ingest it, figure out how to tweak my performance and like shit out a new performance. You know what I mean? Like it was always, you take it a little bit personally every time your hand went the wrong way. You know, it's just, it's hard. It's fucking hard and it's rewarding, but it's also like devastating when you fuck up, right? Like it's just, it's mortifying. So I don't
know. And it's such a specialized,
yes,
competitive field.
Right.
Oh, that, yeah, because there are so many people that are lining up,
right,
that are willing to take the abuse,
yep,
of just the physical toll on their body, the sleepless nights of rehearsing, the hunger of trying to be slim.
Literal hunger, yes.
Yeah, and just sort of, you know, if you've seen the movie Whiplash, for example, about a drummer, like, there are some very abusive instructors.
Yes.
And their teaching method is to yell and berate you.
Yes.
And it is this, because it's such an older art form, it's got a very sort of pre good vibes and positive reinforcement. Yeah,
no, there's not
style of education. It not is not that. Like that.
Yeah, no. I think I kind of wanted to talk to you about, I mean, I could talk about just the dancing in the remake. I could talk about that for an entire hour. So why should we? We should not, probably. But I kind of wanted to, I was thinking, while we're talking about this, I was thinking about the portrayal of gore in both.
Oh, yes.
In both, because they're so very different, but so very effective to me in both. I feel like the Argento is very much more... they're both in your face. I can't say Argento's more in your face than the remake, but it's, I feel like the Argento is more like, we are depicting straight violence, straight gore, whereas in the remake, it is very much, you need to figure out why this gore is happening. Does that make sense?
Yes. And I mean, I wouldn't say that it's not visceral, but it's definitely not, it's not splatter.
Like, right.
The Argento, partly because of, you know, it's a product of its time. Everything's very brightly lit and brightly colored. So when you see blood, it's like kind of this cartoonish, like, Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
And it's very splattery. Right. And for example, one of the first disturbing scenes is maggots are falling from the ceiling.
Yes. Ew.
And there is big, long, extreme close-ups of squirming. Like, I don't even like saying the M word.
No.
It kind of makes me gag. So it very is in your face, like literally super up close, things that are just repulsive and gross.
Yes.
And gory and nasty and revolting.
Right.
And I wouldn't say that there's definitely an element of the abject or the revolting in the new one. But I think in a much darker, slow burn kind of way.
Yes.
And to that point, I mean, I would say that the closest I see now is there's several A24 films that also do horror or gore in this way, where it's there's an uncanniness to it.
Right.
The creepiness is not so much the grossness, but the weirdness,
but the creepiness,
or the unnaturalness
of
it.
Yes.
So, for example, like, I just saw Talk to Me, where this kid just uncontrollably starts banging his head against a table.
Oh.
And the other really creepy A24 is in Hereditary.
Oh,
when,
God, yes. Oh, my God.
Is it Toni Collette?
Yes,
She's banging her head on the...
Yes.
Like, for some reason, people banging their heads...
Freaks you out?
...is so unnatural.
Yes.
It's just... It's weird, because, like, if you saw somebody doing that, you would be like, something is 100%
wrong. We gotta find
somebody...
There
is no possibility that something normal is happening in this situation.
Right.
Like, this person is completely unhinged.
We need to help this person now. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. It's just... such an unusual thing for someone to be doing, that there is no context in which it is not cause for alarm. And so I think that you're probably hitting on the same scene that I was talking about, which is the amazing choreography of the scene where is it Olga, the character, is getting kind of supernaturally contorted and hurt remotely.
Yes.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean... Well, I mean, as much as I can, it is, this scene is crazy, because in another room, in the, what is to be like the practice room or the ballroom or whatever, where the dancing, like, practice takes place, as well as the actual performance area takes place, Susie, our main character, and I mean, I'm going to consider her a protagonist. She is performing this dance that she has basically been watching, like, from afar, from America, like, on, you know, what we assume to be, like, YouTube. Or she's seen this performance before, And she like shows up to this school and just can step in and do like the lead in this performance, which if you've ever had any kind of dance classes or performance training or anything, you're like, that's highly unusual, but good for Susie. But she is so powerful and is clearly like either being influenced by witchery around her or is a witch herself. It's, you know, choose your own adventure. But she is able to perform this dance. And while another student is in a different area, which, by the way, is a room full of mirrors, which are like, they're like beveled mirrors, like on top of themselves. I don't know how to describe that, but it's like layered mirrors. It's very cool. It's not just a straight flat mirror. There's like mirrors with little, like, I don't know, bevels is the only thing I can think of. But anyway, this other student is in this room and she is basically, Susie's like puppeting this other student from afar. And while Susie's performing her dancing elements, Olga is also performing the dancing elements, however, in a very extreme way, in that it is turning her into something else, like in a bad, grotesque
it's like
way.
Breaking her bones, yes. And contorting right. her body.
Yes.
It's almost as if Susie is like next to her, right. And Susie's movements are somehow buffeting her,
right.
And like, so she is, so it's basically this dancer performer in this film is acting out a dance where she has to hit the moves and move as if she is in pain and contorting herself in a way that is impossible or unnatural, and is not under her own control.
Right.
So, I mean, just as a piece of dance,
it's
like, hey, why don't you dance like you're in horrible pain and contort yourself in a way that looks fake or like your arm is broken.
Right.
So one, just prerequisite,
good job.
You must be a contortionist.
Yeah, I mean, crazy.
Second prerequisite, you must be really good at acting and emoting.
Yeah.
And it's unclear. I mean, you in the beginning presume that Susie's completely unaware of this,
right.
And it's sort of like, is this a coincidence? What is happening here? So basically this beautiful tour de force kind of audition that Susie's performing in one room and is sort of immediately introducing her as the protege and the favorite,
right.
of the headmistress. It is juxtaposed with this other student being sort of cast out,
right.
and rejected and punished and literally broken
almost
down.
Almost killed.
Like,
yes.
Yes.
Yeah. It's that's a, like, upon first watch of that was just like a breathtaking scene, not in a good way, but just like you cannot believe the genius of these two scenes playing against each other. And I think the use of breath in the remake is just so, so brilliant, because, you know, if you've ever danced in any class at all, you know, like, it's really hard to control your breathing. In this particular choreography in the remake of Suspiria, it's all very, like, the dancers all breathe at the same time, so you can hear all the breath in the room at exactly, like, almost like as if it was a chorus singing, and how you would punctuate the breath at that time. So the very austere movements coupled with the breath is just like, it's so creepy and so awesome. And it's just like clearly fucking witchcraft. I mean, it's just so like they set the scene just through the dancing.
Yeah, I mean, the maggots falling from the ceiling is obviously repulsive,
yeah,
and like an image that will stay with you forever.
Of course.
And is super creepy, could potentially be supernatural. I mean, it's got biblical proportion,
right.
plague credentials to
yes.
it. But there's something else about, I mean, this violent dance scene, mm-hmm. there is a gore element of seeing somebody like basically having their limbs broken.
Yeah.
But you're also... It's not like you're seeing it's not blood spurting out or what. The thing that's really creepy is you wince when you empathetically when you see somebody like look like they're getting their shoulder dislocated right. or something. But it's more that like the unseen hand.
Yes.
And the fact that she's moving against her own will.
Right.
I think that's the thing that is the really uncanny, eerie, unsettling yes. part. Yes. And it's layered with this like just gut level, like gross, yeah. like makes you sick to your stomach to see, yeah. you know, somebody twisting their ankle or like bending their elbow the wrong way. Like there is that gut level revulsion. But then there's also this psychological like. Oh, that's so creepy.
I think something else I wanted to touch on was just the use of light in the Argento version, or I'm sorry, in the original movie, I should probably say. He evidently, this was one of the, I just Googled this, but this was one of the last uses of Technicolor, if I'm reading that right. Yeah, it was one of the final feature films to be processed in Technicolor using the last remaining machine in Rome. So that's fascinating. It's all very...
Oh, it definitely... I mean, color is a huge part of this and it's all gorgeous. It's yes. super lush. Like I said, like texture is a big part of it and being able to see it in that definition of bright
right.
color
yeah.
is what kind of makes a 2D image... to have a tactile element to it. So yeah, definitely the cinematography, the color, the design.
Yeah.
I would say, I mean, I don't want to say it's superior, but it is just, it's
gorgeous.
Gobsmacking. It's yeah, gorgeous.
It really is. I really enjoy the scenes where, in Argento, where Susie is kind of like, she's kind of out of it. Like she's being manipulated by like her, you know, just proximity to this witchcraft or whatever. And like, she's like awash in this green light when she's very woozy and unable to get her shit together and, you know, doesn't really know what's going on. There's just this like beautiful green, like bright, but not the gross green, like a beautiful, like vivid green light that just washes over her. Which I thought was really interesting choice because I would not necessarily, I guess sometimes like green is like witch's mist or whatever, I guess. But I wasn't thinking of it that way when I was watching it. It just seemed like a really interesting style choice to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything is just fully saturated color in the yes. Argento, which is gorgeous.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess not to beat around the bush, the big difference is that Susie, our protagonist in the original, is a victim.
Yes.
And has no idea what's going on right. and is trying to investigate this mystery. And the big twist in the new one is that is what you think is happening to Susie. You know, she's people around her are going missing or dying. The staff at this place are very weird.
Very weird.
Seem to be secretive. But the big reveal is when they get to the big witch's sabbat where they're going to sacrifice her, she reveals herself as being the goddess, the mother of whispers right. or the mother of sighs, Suspiria,
right.
that they worship. And so she unleashes death upon this cult.
Yes.
And transfigures herself from this sort of like timid mousy ingenue to this sexy feminine scary
yeah.
You know empathetic but also merciless supernatural divine figure
right
and that's the big climax which I love. To me, it was a big twist. I think it's a twist whether you've seen the original or not.
Right.
I think it would be a really gut punch twist if you were expecting the ending of the original. So I like that manipulation of expectation. But I just, as a witch, I think it's just a very interesting move. I think that when you, it is a very lingering, weird feeling.
Right.
Because then you've got to go back and think about the whole entire movie in terms of, well, was Susie always this?
Right.
And she knew it and she was pretending? Or was she this sort of like dormant vessel for this avatar? And and she just, these events triggered this transformation, and this is all very spontaneous, or, you know, is this a possession? Like, what is what's this going process on? You know,
but
or,
I love
or
that.
Is it just that anybody in the right place in the right time in these conditions
right.
Could manifest this power? Like, what is it?
Right.
We don't know.
Don't know.
But and I like that that's ambiguous.
Agreed. I agree. Because it's a very, like, you get to decide how you feel about that ending. And I love the fact that even though she is clearly Mother Suspiriorum, she is the figure that is going around, like, bringing death upon the whole room. Susie is still in the background on the steps as if she's almost directing her astral projection, which I think is so interesting and so unique. I don't know. Just lots of, I think they're both just so brilliant with all of the choices that were made, just so intentional. Also, Tilda Swinton plays two characters, so you know.
Three.
Oh, is it three? Shit.
Yeah.
So she
plays Madame Blanc, yep. She plays Madame Marcos, and she also plays the male psychologist.
She's Marcos. Okay. Yes, and the male psychologist.
Well, and that's another thing, talking about sort of gore or like horror right. versus terror.
Right.
You know, horror being like zombies are horror and vampires would be like terror.
Right.
Horror is stuff that is like gross. Like yeah. like we were saying that, like, it's like gore, it's things that like really punch you in the gut,
right.
where you feel like ugh, like you know, whereas horror is more intellectual
terror.
Like, it's something just is it, yeah, terror is more like
you are afraid, right?
Yeah. Well, like, so like horror is when you recognize something as being like abject or like reminding you of your own mortality.
Right.
So seeing someone being disemboweled or being a zombie or something is basically scary because it's reminding you that that is going to happen to you one
right.
day, that you are going to be out of control of your body and it's going to be rotting.
Terror is like the unknown.
Yeah, terror is that you are confronted with something that is so unfamiliar.
You have no idea.
Because right. in a way, like, a dead body is super familiar. Like, you live in a body. Right. You see dead things all the time. You see things decaying. And it's the fact that it's so familiar that's upsetting. You're like, this is going to be me one day. Whereas terror is that it's something that is so sublime or so awesome in the literal sense of it that it freaks you out because you just feel small and insignificant and you can't comprehend it. So, I would say that the new film balances that really well. So you have this figure of Madame Marcos who in this film is grotesque.
Yes, very
She's
much so.
Morbidly obese. She has, you know, these open weeping sores on her body. Like, it's really everything that our society deems really unacceptably disgusting in a female body. You know, she's overflowing her bounds. She's large. She is
misshapen.
Old.
Yes.
She is misshapen.
Yes.
She is fleshy.
Yes.
She is like,
God.
She's just overflowing with
like
things that we deem as being unfeminine or
right.
too much
right.
or it, you know, and it's meant to be repulsive,
but not in an opulent way, too much, like in a gross way.
Yeah.
Her body's like covered with sores and
yeah
pustules. I don't know how you
yeah
yeah
and like
nasty.
Her voice
yeah.
is like creepy and like her mouth is slightly too large. It's just it's like the anti-mother
right.
sort of in a way. And I found like that a lot of the online criticism of the new film to me really misses the mark, because it talks a lot about, because obviously the whole mythology of the original Argento trilogy is these three mothers, quote unquote,
right.
that are sort of these like semi-mythical or semi-divine or, you know, transfigured humans, but they're called, you know, the Mother of Tears, the Mother of Sighs. What is the other one? Just totally blanked out.
The Inferno, or wait, Inferno, Mother of Tears. Mm. Yeah, Inferno, Mother of Tears, and Suspiria are the three movies.
Yeah, but I forget what the three actual mothers are.
Oh, I forget because they say it at the end of the new movie, too. Sorry. Clickety click click. Here. I'm looking to.
Oh, Mother of Darkness. Duh. Mater Tenebrarum.
Tenebrarum. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So, it's so obviously like motherhood is like a big theme in this.
Right.
And for me, that's why I like the new one being an exclusively female space.
Yes.
And I think that, I think if you are approaching this in a kind of pedantic or just from a very male gaze kind of thing, it's like, oh, the so-called Mother Marcos, or she is so gross. So it's like she's not motherly, because you're thinking of like the Virgin Madonna or something. But the reality is that one, mother, like physical childbirth
is gross.
Yeah. Like, I mean,
it's also not, beautiful.
It's completely natural and beautiful. Yes. But the thing is, like,
there's
it's very
blood
different
and
than what
bodily
there's,
fluids there's, and
yes,
cords
there's
and
like
things.
Shit
yes.
and piss and yeah. blood yes. and all of and screaming right. and yeah. So second of all, like, I think any woman's relationship with her own mother is a lot of that. There's these moments of like admiration yep. because your mother is your first model of what femininity is supposed to be. She's also potentially someone that is enforcing that femininity on you, depending on what your relationship is. Right. So, you know, being like, don't eat that, right. you know, moment on the lips is forever on the hips or,
yeah.
you know, or yeah. things like that in it. So, you know, sort of teaching you about how to perform femininity in a positive way or potentially in a negative way.
Right.
And then there are moments where you are like disgusted and revolted by your mom, you know, like that she's like so deeply uncool, or you know, you look at her
and, yeah.
and you see, okay, this is what an adult female body looks like, and that is like weird and strange and upsetting that's what I'm gonna be, you know.
Right.
So, and then as your mother ages, there's also that element of that horror, like
yes.
I was saying, like seeing a zombie is creepy and gross because you're like, I don't want to become a walking corpse,
but seeing your mom is like even harder sometimes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you feel guilty
yes.
that you're like, this person is, you know, they're not at their best anymore.
Right.
You know, maybe they have dementia.
Yep.
Maybe they have stroke. Maybe they're having like language processing problems. Maybe they have cancer. And so now they look different.
Right.
They're emaciated. They're losing, you know,
right.
just all the things that come with aging.
Right.
You know, plus all the shit that our culture puts on that for
sure.
women.
Yes.
But so the idea that like, it's just like, oh, you know, good mother, bad, like monster.
Right.
You know,
that's
virgin,
very patriarchal,
sweet, caring
yeah.
mother, and then gross, monstrous thing. Like, to me, that's so reductive.
Well, it also,
I feel
that,
like
go ahead. Having that discussion dovetails nicely with our Hecate class, honestly.
Oh, yes.
Because what have we been talking about this whole time of how Hecate, like, think of her as you would not normally, you know, think of if you consider her like a dark goddess, a darkness mother, think of her as a youthful, bright child. Think of her, or and vice versa, like she can also be like eater of filth, you know, like, so this dovetails very nicely into that conversation.
Yeah. So, and I think that that's maybe why this new version kind of perplexed viewers and critics.
Mm.
Because to me, it wasn't like, oh, you know, naive farm girl turns into homicidal witch monster.
Right.
Or, you know, strict headmistress is sort of coded as this prudish, you know, butchy lesbian, like the second teacher in charge, particularly in the, so not Madame Blanc, but the other one in the Argento, to me was coded very like butch lesbian.
Yes.
In a sort of almost comedic or derogatory way.
Yeah. Caricature.
Sort of this Miss Trunchbull sort of, you know, very boxy suit. Menswear, like high collars, wearing a tie, very severe haircut, you know, strong jawline. It meant to be kind of, I think, negatively interpreted as unfeminine or butch. Right. And I feel like in the new one, you get a variety of female bodies and female, relationships. So not only do you see different body types or in different ages, but you also see different kinds of relationships. You see like friends, you see rivals, you know, so different kind of peer relationships. You see different mentor student relationships. You see an antagonistic mentor student relationship. You see sort of this infighting among the matrons of this organization. So just all the different kinds of ways that women can be in a maternal role to each other that is not just a kind of warm, snuggly, nurturing, like, come lay your head on my bosom and I will comfort you sort of way.
Right. Yeah. Well, I feel like we've done this film justice now. Or at least hopefully piqued your interest to go watch both. Because I think they're really stunning up against each other for different reasons. And you can definitely see almost where the remake, like, kind of just wants to drastically change that ending. You know, rather than everybody just perishing in a fire, like, we're going to make it a little more violent. So, and there's no like discontinuation of the coven. Cause I mean, Susie's still a thing. She's going to live forever as a, as Mother Suspiria. So I love the remake. I will watch the original again. I don't know. I kind of want to make it an annual thing just to put them up against each other and just, it, like, enjoy the lushness of that original version, because it's
I feel like our conclusions were kind of pro the new one, but I mean, obviously you got to give props to the original.
Absolutely.
The new one wouldn't exist without it.
That's right.
And it, I mean, it is just a visual feast.
Yes,
it's gorgeous. I love the score. It's like really bananas. I mean, just so many things are firing on all cylinders, like the sets, the hair and makeup, you know, the score, the architecture, the lighting, like the camera angles, it's all just over the top in a really satisfying artistic way. The last thing I wanted to at least give some lip service to, and I don't want to get into it because we don't have time, but so Suspiria and this whole like three mothers mythology, that Dario Argento created for this trilogy of films is actually a reference to Thomas de Quincey's 1845 essay Suspiria de Profundis.
Correct.
So there is a whole bunch of shit that we could get into about that and what that is about how that is different or the same as what Argento came up with, and then how that is reinterpreted in the new one. But I just wanted to throw that out there. If you want to go down a rabbit hole, you totally should.
You should.
But really just interesting stuff about sort of like modern myth making and like modern imaginings of these like primal, paradoxical goddess forms.
Mother relationships. Yes. Yeah. Oh, man. Really, it's a great couple of films to watch in October for sure.
Yes, definitely. Right?
Well, hey, we did it. Finally. I was really looking forward to this one. So please go watch both of these films and do your own pondering. It'll be great.
Yeah, I feel like there's so much more that we could say, but
we could. But this was a good primer. So, all right. Well, until next time.
Hocus pocus, bitches.